witnessing the delivery of a petition to the Obama administration protesting the deportation of Central American refugees.
And I saw records made, music literally written in wax.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 33rd Real Music Film Festival, running through February 8th. Friday, February 5th, will show American Epic. The film pieces together the extraordinary 1920s story of record companies leaving the big city to tour America's backroads and capture for the first time the raw musical expressions of rural cultures. These field recordings, initially aimed for the rural...
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
This program is made possible in part by...
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
What are the things that we could do to signal to the transgender community that this is a good and safe and wholesome place for you and the gifts that you bring?
When you have been so deeply vilified and rejected by society, you assume that you're not welcome unless you are specifically told that you are welcome.
Phyllis Nash said that she was commissioned to write the screenplay 18 years ago, which is a long time for a lesbian story to sit in the closet.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappelle. Mexico's High Court issues another marriage equality ruling. Everything you wanted to know about welcoming trans folks, and Kate and Rooney's love affair with Carol. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Carol Myers.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending January 30th, 2016. 11 members of Mexico's Supreme Court unanimously ruled on January 26th that denying lesbian and gay couples access to the civil institution of marriage in the state of Jalisco was unconstitutional. Jalisco is home to Mexico's second largest city, Guadalajara, as well as the vacation resort of Puerto Vallarta. Jalisco joins five other states, Chihuahua, Coahuila, Guerrero, Nayarit, and Quintana Roo, where gay and lesbian couples can now legally marry. It's also been possible in the Federal District of Mexico City since 2010. A high court ruling subsequently ordered all Mexican states to recognize legally performed marriages of same-gender couples, even if they don't sanction them in their own jurisdictions. Same-gender couples can currently marry in the other 25 states only after getting a personalized injunction against the civil registry from a judge, called an amparo. That requires a lawyer, the equivalent of about $1,000 US, and a month of waiting time. There is no mechanism in Mexico for the Supreme Court to issue another North American-style ruling to end civil marriage bans in every state. Same-gender couples can only collect amparos on a state-by-state basis. Or they can challenge a state's law with an action of unconstitutionality within 30 days of its coming into force. That's how Jalisco's ban was overturned. Supreme Court Justice Olga Sanchez Cordero told the EFE news agency that other Mexican states should change their discriminatory statutes or have them eventually declared unconstitutional by the High Court, prompting some activists to declare that, however torturous, the nation of Mexico is on the path to full marriage equality.
But Romania's Orthodox Church-inspired Coalition for Family, made up of 23 associations and NGOs, announced this week that it had already gathered 825,000 signatures to constitutionally define civil marriage in the southeastern European nation as heterosexual only. Romanian Orthodox priests began a much-publicized signature-gathering drive in early January to amend the Constitution. Mihai De Georgiou, who heads the coalition's petition drive, told reporters that his committee consists of 16 members of all religions, including Orthodox, Roman Catholics, Greek Catholics, Baptists, and Pentecostals. He said that some 80,000 volunteers will continue to gather signatures until the six-month period prescribed by the law will end. He said the definition of marriage in the civil code is the union between a man and a woman, while the current constitutional definition speaks about spouses in generic terms. We basically want to harmonize the two definitions, he explained, by including the definition of the civil code in the Romanian constitution. According to Wikipedia, the Romanian constitution allows a referendum only to suspend the president from office or to amend the constitution. However, the document also says that a referendum can be called on matters of national interest by the president of Romania after consultation with parliament. Curve magazine reports that the coalition must gather 500,000 signatures to file for a referendum to amend the constitution.
Hundreds of thousands of religious Italians opposed to civil unions for lesbian and gay couples rallied in Rome on January 30th, although the crowd count may have fallen short of organizers' predictions. While Family Day was led by priests of the Roman Catholic Church, which is strongly opposed to the civil unions bill currently being debated in Parliament, members of Islamic groups and representatives of other religions against the bill also joined the rally, along with the coalition government's interior and environmental ministers. Pope Francis has expressed his own opposition, saying last week that the traditional family is the family God wants. One of the Family Day organizers, Massimo Gandolfini, claimed that 2 million people rallied at Rome's historic Circus Maximus, telling reporters that Italy is one of the few Western countries that is still resisting this deviation. But most news agencies placed the crowd at no more than 500,000. The gay.it website called the event a flop.
Family Day came a week after hundreds of thousands of rainbow flag-waving people in support of civil unions demonstrated in more than 100 cities across the country. Polling seems to suggest that a healthy majority in Italy support civil unions for gay and lesbian couples, although close to 75% in those surveys are opposed to allowing same-gender couples to adopt their spouse's biological children. Parliament has rejected previous civil unions bills, but Prime Minister Matteo Renzi is pushing for passage and claims to have the necessary votes this time.
The march down the aisle of marriage equality in Taiwan continues to gather steam. New Taipei City and Tainan this week joined Kaohsiung, Taipei, and Taichung in allowing same-gender couples to register their relationships. The moves have been more symbolic than practical, although each municipality will recognize a person's same-gender partner in hospital visitation and medical decision-making. Taiwanese citizens can register with just their ID cards. Foreign residents can also register with their passports and residence permits. Efforts to move a marriage equality bill through parliament in recent years have been stalled by a small but vocal Christian fundamentalist minority. However, LGBT activists are hoping that the island's newly elected first female president, Tsai Ing-wen, who is said to be supportive of marriage equality, will help push the reform through during her term in office.
Portugal's equality advocates are probably mumbling, "Don't let the door hit you on the way out," following one of the last acts of center-right Social Democratic Party president Anibal Cavaco Silva. He vetoed a bill this week that would have opened adoptions to same-gender couples. It passed in Parliament in December and would also have allowed access to medically assisted fertility treatments to lesbian couples. The 76-year-old Silva explained in a media statement that it is important that such a big change on a sensitive social topic is not entered into force without a broad public debate. Agence France-Presse reports that the center-left parliamentary majority will attempt to override Silva's veto. He asked in his message to MPs that they consider it a matter of the child's best interest rather than as an equal rights issue. He leaves office on March 9th. Many gay and lesbian couples are already raising children together in Portugal under existing laws. They've been able to adopt their partner's children since 2013. Adoption is also open to any individual, regardless of sexual orientation.
In other news, Indonesia's Minister of Higher Education, Muhammad Nasir, came under fire this week for implying that LGBT students should not be allowed to attend the nation's universities because, he said, there are values and moral standards that must be upheld. The campus is a moral guardian. His remarks came in response to reports of the establishment of the Support Group and Resource Center on Sexuality Studies at the University of Indonesia, although school officials in the overwhelmingly Muslim nation said that it was not an official university-affiliated student society. Nasir does have his supporters. A spokesperson for Indonesia's Child Protection Commission, identified only as Erlinda, told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation,
"Don't just look at this LGBT as a lifestyle, but see that it's connected to other things like drugs that could then lead to committing crimes."
Sociologist Musni Umar told the broadcast outlet that
when people are not attracted to the opposite sex and instead are only attracted to people of the same sex, it means that Armageddon is here.
But Nasir's comments were widely condemned by human rights groups both in the country and around the world.
Nasir tried to clarify his original comments a few days later, thinking that it may take some of the heat off. But he essentially said that LGBT students are welcome at the nation's schools of higher education as long as they stay in the closet. "I would only ban LGBT people from entering campuses if they engage in disgraceful behavior, like making love or showing affection," he told his many Twitter followers. The country's Alliance of Independent Journalists held a series of intensive workshops in Jakarta this week to address charges by LGBT activists, the vast majority of whom are frequent targets of verbal and or physical abuse, that media coverage of the community tends to be sensationalistic or swaddled in self-righteous morality.
And finally, for the second year in a row, all 20 nominees in the major Oscar acting categories are white, and the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences has been criticized for the lack of more colorful nominees by not only those in the African American community, but by other people of color and their Caucasian allies. Count among them twice Oscar-nominated English actor Sir Ian McKellen, probably best known for his role as Gandalf the Wizard in The Hobbit film series. During an interview this week on Britain's Sky News, the out 76-year-old thespian pointed out that people of color are not the only minorities with insufficient face time in Hollywood.
"I think you have to live in Hollywood, where the Oscars mean so much more than they do elsewhere, to understand why people's feelings are running so high. And the fact that black people feel underrepresented in studio movies and big movies, well, it's what women thought for a long time. It's what gay people like myself still think. And it's a legitimate complaint, and the Oscars has become the focus of those worries. So, I sympathize."
That's News Wrap for the week ending January 30th, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Carol Myers.
We'll hear from the stars of a new breed of lesbian love story later in the program. In a dialogue between retired gay Episcopal Bishop Gene Robinson and transgender Baptist pastor Allison Robinson, the Center for American Progress introduced the new resource Transgender Welcome last week on This Way Out. In part two of our coverage of that event, the two unrelated Robinsons and members of the audience discuss practical tips for religious groups that want to encourage inclusion.
"Let us stop the racism. Stop the sexism. Stop the hate and jealousy. Can we stop all the laughing and all the queer bashing on just because we're different than you are? Why can't we help each other? Maybe a sister.
were a part of a congregation that wanted to express our welcome of transgender people. What are the things that we could do to signal to the transgender community that this is a good and safe and wholesome place for you and the gifts that you bring?
I need to start off with sort of the negating position, right? That unfortunately, no matter how many rainbow flags you hang up, no matter how big your pride booth is, right, or how gay your pastor is, those things alone will not be enough. When you have been so deeply vilified and rejected by society, you assume that you're not welcome unless you are specifically told that you are welcome. And so the challenge is finding ways to do that for people who otherwise would never think to come through your door. I think that being involved in things that matter to transgender people and being publicly involved is a great step forward here. Every year, the third week of November, communities all around the world commemorate the International Transgender Day of Remembrance by hosting an event like that, by having your staff or members of your congregation present at an event like that. It shows that you understand, or at least are seeking to understand better, by creating space for conversations like the one we're having here today, facilitated open conversations with religious leaders in their community and others, inviting a group of transgender people to come and to share their stories, and then putting that out into your community, putting it up on your marquee, right, is a good step forward. And I think doing the work that's required to welcome transgender people once they do walk through the door is critical here. So, you know, doing what needs to be done to ensure that transgender people don't need to fear using the restroom in your church or synagogue building is important. That the parents of transgender children know that their kids will be loved and treated in a way that's consonant with their identity. Those kinds of things matter a great deal, because the last thing you want to do is bring us, imply that we're welcome, and have us come through the door and then have an experience that's not in harmony with that.
I love the idea of that showing up is a way to signal to the transgender community that indeed you're serious about these things, and you're not just putting up a rainbow flag and hope that that does all the work for you. So now to you. Questions that you have about the resource, questions you have about the transgender experience, questions for either Allison or myself.
My name's Rabbi Adam Rosenwasser. I work here at a congregation in Washington, D.C. And one thing you touched on a little was the sort of amount of children that are dealing with issues around gender identity. And we're seeing that a lot in our congregation. And I'm wondering, as a faith leader, how do we best support those children, especially when they have parents who, when they're not so supportive, it puts us in sort of this strange spot as leaders who are looking out for their children's welfare, but also these are minors and they're sort of under, in a way, their parents' control. And I'd really appreciate some sort of, if you have any practical tips.
What a critical question. I would say this: finding ways to communicate to children their value in the eyes of God, despite what society broadly may be communicating to them. This is our work as people who minister to children, right? With my own kids, from the time they were very, very little, when I put them to bed each night, I would say to them something like this: do you know that God is crazy about you? You don't need to change a bit to be worthy of the love of God, because God already thinks you're absolutely awesome and amazing. If only more of our children heard those kinds of things, right? If they're not hearing them from their parents, then thank God they can hear them from us. And with, you know, having said that, I as a parent, right, I also want to say that we make mistakes, right? With the best of intentions and the purest of motives. So I would hope that we would be offering that same grace to parents, no matter where they're at, right? God loves you just like you are.
My name is Josie Lehrer, and I direct a project called the Men's Story Project, which is basically men sharing personal stories in public that aim to challenge and help transform social ideas about masculinity in the world for everyone's benefit. And I'm really wanting to better think and understand about the topic of prejudice reduction. Yeah, and what is the virtue of hearing people's personal stories? So I'm curious as to your thoughts on that.
My experience is that that stories have a power like almost nothing else, right, to change minds and to move hearts. I say almost nothing else, because even the power of stories pales in comparison to the power of relationships. Moving beyond having simply heard a story to becoming a part of the story of someone's life, the power there is unimaginable. And as I shared earlier, I think is still largely untapped with trans communities.
Rob Keith, and I'm a Unitarian Universalist minister doing consulting work at the intersection of faith and sexuality and gender and reproductive rights issues, and I spend a lot of time thinking about the ways these issues are connected, and in particular the kind of attitude of moralism that persists on the far right, where there's really only one right way to be in the world, and if you're found, you know, to be not conforming to that, then you're punished, versus this attitude of pluralism. Allison, I'd be interested in hearing you talk about the ways in which you see kind of the struggle for trans liberation as connected or not connected from the struggle for kind of sexual liberation and for kind of reproductive health and rights as well.
I think that in many ways, we're fighting the same demons in the world in each of these movements. We have kind of in the most proximate sense named that misogyny, this understanding that women are somehow less than. My own experience of living out my trans identity in the world has taught me how much and how deeply misogyny underlies so much of the behavior that we would call transphobic behavior. I think it might actually go deeper than that, though. We, as human beings, have a deep-seated, deeply encoded fear of the other. It is a coding that is older than humanity itself. We see sameness as safety and difference as danger. This is why most of us, when we look around the 10 or 12 people that we feel closest to in the world, will see people who are mostly like us, right? Not because we're bad people or evil people, but because we're human beings who, by virtue of the way our brains work, feel more comfortable around people who are like ourselves. If we are ever to become more than that, we must learn to set aside comfort for compassion and step into spaces that are unfamiliar, unusual for us, and learn what it means to embody our own unique humanity in those spaces, right? Where our humanity is not shared in all of its details by everyone who is around us. In my own tradition, we look ahead toward an eschaton, an end of all things, right? In which we are all one. I think if you want to be able to experience that in the world today, you need to step into those spaces. And I think you will be deeply, deeply blessed if you do.
This is my prayer.
That was Bishop Gene Robinson and Baptist pastor Allison Robinson discussing the publication of Transgender Welcome. The Center for American Progress resource booklet can be downloaded from americanprogress.org.
Attention all LGBT, U.S. history buffs, collectors, and listener supporters.
You can now own a very special edition of This Way Out.
Here's a taste.
Today, being gay is not a crime.
This is going to lead to the legalization of same-sex marriage.
Children born today will grow up in a world without DOMA.
This is social engineering by a court.
Is this him?
Yes, it is, Mr. President.
I just want to say congratulations.
Today, some of the darkest 24 hours in our nation's history.
It's the day I finally get to look at the man that I love and finally say, will you please marry me?
From outlaws to in-laws traces the legal evolution of the U.S. Supreme Court.
From the decriminalization of private consensual adult gay sex in 2003 to making marriage equality the law of the land in 2015.
This special edition features the voices of dozens of equality advocates over those years who made the journey possible.
Despite always outspoken opposition along the way.
From Outlaws to In-Laws also includes a wide variety of thematic music.
You'll find all the info you need about this very special edition of This Way Out at
thiswayout.org.
Well, isn't that special?
The stars of the lesbian romance Carol have each received acting nominations in several Hollywood awards ceremonies this year, including the Golden Globes, the SAG-AFTRA Awards, and the Oscars. The film, based on Patricia Highsmith's landmark novel The Price of Salt, has also garnered several Best Picture nods. Carol follows the 1950s New York romance between Best Lead Actress nominee Cate Blanchett as a woman trapped in a loveless heterosexual marriage and Best Supporting Actress nominee Rooney Mara as a young department store clerk.
Where'd you learn so much about train sets?
Oh, I read. Too much, probably.
That's refreshing.
Thank you.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
The two stars discussed the film's history and social relevance during a Variety screening series conversation with Justin Chang, the Trade magazine's chief film critic. He asked Mara and Blanchett about working with gay director Todd Haynes.
It never felt like direction. It always just felt like he's so collaborative. It always felt like a collaboration. And Todd does so much work before we even get to set that he was kind enough to include us on. So when we were on set, you know, we didn't have that much time to shoot this film or that much money, so there wasn't really a lot of time to be sort of figuring it out while we were there. We had to do a lot of that before we ever got to set.
He'll ask you a question about something, which means that every time you go into a take, you're seeking to answer something. And not that you necessarily pin it down and answer it, but it means that you go in trying to discover something. And, you know, as Rooney said, he's so deeply collaborative. And so, you know, people talk about, you know, how was it to work with Rooney, or I don't know, maybe they ask you how it was to work with me, which is fabulous.
Wasn't it Rooney?
But it was very much working with Todd. And so it always, and that was really, it meant that your relationship through Ed Lachman to Todd through the camera was a really active relationship.
Blanchett was asked about the development process and when she decided to commit to the film.
Phyllis Nash, who wrote the screenplay, said that she was commissioned to write the screenplay 18 years ago, which is a long time for a lesbian story to sit in the closet. I don't know. I mean, it becomes immaterial once the thing gets made as to who came on first and how long. But I don't know, maybe 6 years, and then. But it wasn't really till Todd came on board that it became a film, and then obviously he wanted, you know, everyone wanted to work with Rooney, and then it took off.
Do Mara and Blanchett think Carol is political?
I've never thought of the film as political. I think that's one of the great gifts of the film, is that it's not shoving an agenda on anyone. It's really just, you know, it allows the audience to watch it without any defenses up, because it's not trying to push any sort of agenda onto you. And since the movie's come out, most of the questions aren't about the fact that it's a love story between two women. It's really just about the fact that it's a love story.
I think my fear was that this was somehow going to be seen as a film that would only interest women. Mm. And the response from men I've found really heartwarming is that it has that universal quality. You know, if this film had been made 18 years ago, I think that it would have been viewed through a much more political prism, whereas I think that the political conversation in society has in most Western, English-speaking countries has shifted enough for this to be seen as a love story.
That was Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara at a Variety screening series discussion of their multi-award-nominated film, Carol. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, John Dyer V and Carol Myers contributed program material, with thanks as always to Steve Pride. Diana Vanderbilt with J.D. Sebastian performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Yovana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. You'll find more information about the show, the crew, a video teaser for our special From Outlaws to In-Laws compilation CD, and even more at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078 USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Lucia Chappelle. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on Contact FM Hamilton, New Zealand, KBRP Bisbee, Arizona, WXOJ Northampton, Massachusetts, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Kyla.
And this is Jay.
And you're listening to Strange Fruit on WFPL.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We took last week off, and we used that as a chance to kind of replay some of our favorite episodes from 2015.
Yes.
And so we are back with a brand new set of Juicy Fruit. There's been a lot happening in the last couple of weeks.
So let's
hop right into it, especially as it relates to Race Doc. There's been a lot going on. There is one story I want to point out first before we hop into like the discussion of the Oscars. You know, I guess what's on everybody's minds right now is the hashtag #OscarsSoWhite.
Yes.
Now, again, this has kind of happened last year as well, where the majority, last year was the majority, this year is exclusively all the nominees for lead and supporting actor and actress are all white people.
Mm-hmm,
despite the fact that there were several movies that featured people of color, and especially black people, that really, there was a lot of Oscar buzz. There was Will Smith, who did Concussion. That was Straight Outta Compton. And the people said that was a really brilliant movie. And even in the case of Straight Outta Compton, I believe the screenwriter was nominated, who's a white person, or two white people who are the screenwriters were nominated, but the director, who's black, and the actors who are black were not nominated. So
People
have been up in arms. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. But we want to give a shout out to our friend to the show, Dan Cannon. You all remember Dan because he is one of the attorneys who took Kentucky's marriage equality case all the way to the Supreme Court. Dan is continuing to do the right thing. He's taking on a new client, Doc. Her name is LaToya Mayberry. I don't know if you saw this in the news. Mayberry is a trans woman.
Yes.
She was recently paroled from prison. And as sometimes happens, you have to go to like a halfway house. And so She's not from Louisville, but she gets paroled from Luther Luckett, which I think is in Lexington. She gets sent to a halfway house in Louisville. This particular halfway house is called St. Anne's. It's run by Dismas Charities. And it is a halfway house for, quote, men, right? And so she, and there are supposed to be federal regulations regarding how you house trans women. But anyway, she's sent to this particular halfway house that is for men. And she reports to the powers that be that she feels unsafe, that she's being catcalled, that she's being assaulted, that people are threatening to assault her, and she feels like there's a lack of security. There's only one officer at any given time. There's a lack of oversight, and she really feels like her life is at risk. And so she files a petition through her parole officer and through the state to be transferred to another facility that's safer. Well, the director of the halfway house, his name is Mark Meredith. He's like the boss.
Mm-hmm.
He writes a letter of his own to the state and says, no, you should disregard Ms. Mayberry's petition. He said that she's, quote, trying to manipulate the system. He feels like, no, you're not unsafe. There's nothing wrong. You're just trying to manipulate the system.
How is she trying to manipulate the system?
I don't know. Okay, That's what he says. So he writes a letter to intercept her letter, and I guess subsequently her claim is denied. She's not transferred. Shortly thereafter, she is raped by another inmate in the another inmate in the halfway house. She is raped. When she goes back to the director and reports her rape, he again says that she's lying, that she trying to manipulate the system. Eventually, she goes to the hospital and is given an examination, and I guess it is determined that, in fact, she has been the victim of rape or sexual assault. And, in fact, the alleged perpetrator was arrested and prosecuted. So it was, in fact, corroborated that she had, in fact, been the victim of sexual assault, as she thought she was going to be. And so now Dan has taken on her case, the case of LaToya Mayberry, and they are suing both Dismas Charities as an organization and also Mark Meredith as an individual, because they have a duty under it's like a, it's like the Federal Rape Elimination Act. They have a duty to protect people, you know, of all inmates.
Yeah,
just because
yeah.
you're an inmate doesn't somehow mean that you give up your right to safety.
And I'm glad she's suing them as she should. And I'm glad that, you know, shout out to Dan. How you doing?
Yeah.
How you doing, Dan? shout out to Dan for taking up the case. Because,
in a very
public
way as well, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. It's ridiculous. It's repugnant. They should have been ashamed of themselves that they did this. I mean, not only is it transphobic, but it's, you know, putting someone in a space where they're going to be violated and violence is going to be enacted against them,
yeah.
and then to not be believed.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm like, is this the Pentagon? Is it the military? You know what I mean? I was just like,
yeah,
you know,
that you can become a victim, and then people
yeah.
don't even believe you once you've been victimized.
Yeah.
And I don't know, people. What is up this notion that people think that because you and I know that I believe in crime and punishment to some degree, but mm-hmm. that people have this notion that once you become a prisoner, that you somehow give up your right to safety or your right to warm blanket or to food. Do prisoners give up their right to, you know, the basic humanity when they get locked up?
No, they don't. And in fact, there have been other studies that happen in women's state penitentiaries and stuff like that, where guards will withhold sanitary napkins and different things to embarrass inmates. I mean, there are a lot of underhanded tactics that go on in the prison industrial complex to deny,
humiliate and to dehumanize.
I mean, and folks are already, I mean, they're in prison, they're, you know, serving their debt to society, quote unquote, if you will.
Yeah.
And inherently from the inside out, the prison system is extremely flawed. And then on top of that, they have to deal with assault from guards,
yeah.
being denied certain things.
Medicine,
yeah.
you know, people have died, mm-hmm. and we talked on the show about people who've died in medical custody because they've been refused necessary medicine and,
mm-hmm.
and those kinds of things. So anyway, I wanted to just give a quick mention of the case of LaToya Mayberry and also to Dan Cannon, who's our friend to the show. And we're going to stay tuned. We're going to keep our eye to that case, and hopefully they will see victory. So shout out to LaToya and Dan. Doc, as we mentioned, there's the case of the Oscar So White, that for the second year in a row, black people simply have been underrepresented. So Jada Pinkett Smith, Spike Lee, there have been several black actors and filmmakers who have called for a boycott of the Oscars.
Yes.
First of all, before we talk about Idris Elba, and he made some really wonderful remarks to the British Parliament about the lack of representation in the TV and film industry, what do you make of this Oscar So White situation? Are you surprised? Are you disappointed?
No, I'm not surprised at all, and I'm not disappointed. I mean, when it comes to the Oscars and it comes to Academy Awards, there's a history there and also like a precedent for them basically not rewarding, nominating, or recognizing the contributions of many African-American and other thespians of color, right? So even in 1973, Marlon Brando, who was going to win Best Actor for The Godfather, his role as Frank Corleone, he protested the awards and actually had this woman named Little Feather
yeah.
come and accept the or basically
refuse
the award on his behalf, saying that he really thought the depiction of First Nation folks, Native American folks, was racist.
Yeah.
And stereotypical. And so therefore he was disgusted and he didn't want to take his award. So, and when it comes to African Americans specifically in the Academy Awards and the Oscars, the thing about it is it's like one, even this year, the only two African Americans they might have been able to nominate is maybe the folks from Straight Outta Compton, Will Smith and Idris Elba.
Yeah.
That to me is the travesty. There's not even a wide range of representation to even get rewarded in the first place. And then you have many mainstream filmmakers and directors and producers who don't think of actors and actresses of color as being universal thespians.
Yeah.
So they feel like if there's more than one African-American or one more than one person of
Latino
color in a film,
yeah.
it makes the film Latino.
A black film.
Or it makes it a black film.
Yeah.
I mean, even take, for instance, the case of The Best Man 2, when Los Angeles Times wrote and
about
said...
About it was a race film.
They said a race film does well.
Yeah.
And it's like, first of all, no one in the first Best Man nor the second talks anything or says anything about race.
Yeah.
Doesn't say anything that has to do politically with institutionally with race, but because the majority of actors and actresses in the film are black, it's all of a sudden seen as a black film.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I just had this conversation with my students on Tuesday in class because they wanted to ask me about the Oscars as well. And that's what I was saying. I said the problem with the Academy and the Oscars is because they're racist within, right?
Yeah.
And always have been. When they have recognized African-Americans, essentially we've been recognized for controlling stereotypical images, that of the thug and Denzel in Training Day, that of the tragic mulatto Andor, like kind of Jezebel motif, Halle Berry in Monsters Ball, the bad black mother, Monique in Precious.
The trickster Whoopi Goldberg in Ghost.
Or The Maid, right? With Hattie McDaniel and Gone with the Wind, and then again in The Help.
Yeah.
Right? So we have only...
Despite the fact that there have been some really redemptive characters, there have been some awesome redemptive characters over the course of American cinema that have continued to be overlooked.
All the time. So even when we are there, I remember the year that Color Purple comes out, racist out of Africa sweeps all of the Academy Awards that year. Whoopi Goldberg doesn't get recognized. Margaret Avery doesn't get recognized. They gave really impactful and important performances in that film. But again, they would rather reward racist out of Africa that I guarantee hardly any black people saw because of its racism, and give those awards and recognize that. So to me, I do think that there is a lot to be said here in terms of the lack of representation. And I think it's no coincidence that they have put a black woman as the president.
Yeah.
So it can seem as if we're about diversity and to add insult to injury. And then Chris Rock hosted.
Yeah,
same thing.
And then to add insult to injury, there's now this movement to get more black people to be presenters of the statues. And so it's like, so you want black people to give gold to white, you know, like you want black people to help be present these awards they weren't nominated for. But Idris Elba, who we love, now keep in mind that Idris Elba was rumored to play a James Bond, but white people were saying that he couldn't play James Bond because he was too black. He was too
urban. Exactly.
But he addressed the UK Parliament earlier this month, and he criticized the diversity problem in the TV and film industry. And he said that this was the most important speech he's ever made. And even though he wrote it several weeks ago, it coincided with the current uproar over what's happened with the Academy Awards. So just a bit of what he said, Doc, he said, quote, "I'm not here to talk about black people. I'm here to talk about diversity. Diversity in the modern world is more than just skin color. It's gender, age, disability, sexual orientation, social background, and most important of all, as far as I'm concerned, diversity of thought." And so he really said that this is a problem that affects not just America, but also Britain and the entire world. And so he really has been a very vocal advocate there in the British Parliament for diversifying the industry. And he says, you have to ask the question, are black people normally playing petty criminals? Are women always the love interest? Are talking about men? Are gay people always stereotyped? Are disabled people ever seen at all? So shout out to Idris Elba, who really is speaking out in a very public way. And we appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
We're also really excited about another person who's bucking the trend, Doc. Nate Parker just negotiated the most lucrative deal in the history of the Sundance Film Festival.
Yeah,
he has sold to Fox Searchlight his movie called Birth of a Nation. Mm-hmm. Birth of a Nation tells the story of whom?
Well, you mean his or the original?
But we'll talk about that in a second. From the title. His version of Birth of a Nation
Tells the story of Nat Turner and Nat Turner's rebellion.
And
on
who
Harper's
was Nat
Ferry.
Turner, for folks who don't know?
Nat Turner.
It's probably the most famous kind
of. Yeah, Nat Turner, he was an enslaved African American, and he led an enslaved African rebellion of enslaved folks and freed blacks in Southampton County, Virginia, in 1831. And it resulted in the deaths of at least 50 white folks and at least 200 black people, right? But it was an uprising, and it was one of the most known about recorded resistances. As we know, there were many throughout history, but the problem, again, with the white supremacist myth is that we don't really hear all of the different ways in which
people
enslaved
rebelled.
Africans resisted, right? Yeah. So the one famous Amistad, when they kind of turned the ship around, and Nat Turner are pretty much the most famous.
Yeah, so he has written and produced and self-funded this movie to tell the story of Nat Turner in a very brilliant way. And so, again, as we mentioned...
And it got a standing ovation. It got a standing ovation at Sundance. Yeah,
and there were several other companies from Netflix and Fox and HBO who were really competing for the rights to worldwide distribution of this movie. And $17.5 million is the most lucrative deal of any movie to ever come through Sundance. Now, as we mentioned, Doc, the title of his movie is Birth of a Nation.
Yes.
I know, you know, some people probably know that Birth of a Nation was also the title of a movie, one of the early, I guess, motion pictures. And it was written by...
D.W. Griffith.
Who actually is from Kentucky. You know, I always like to bring it back and make it full circle.
It's actually, the film is based on a book called The Klansman by T.F. Dixon Jr.
Yeah.
And it's a racist, one of the most racist films. But, you know, what's interesting, I mean, speaking of the Academy Awards and the Oscars, it is seen as a cinematic classic.
It is.
Along with Gone with the Wind, in which you have a number of white male actors dousing themselves in blackface. And basically, it's this idea of what's going to happen to the United States once enslaved Africans are free. So it shows them being in school and drinking liquor at desk. It shows them actively searching for and preying on young white virgins and trying to rape them.
Brutalize them.
It shows them kind of dressing up and killing a whole bunch of white folks. And it was made in 1915, and it's a silent film.
Yeah.
But it is seen as this, you know, well-regarded classic, and just for cinematic purposes only. Yeah. But I find
it was one of those movies we talk about how pop culture and media can shape race relations, and so it was a movie that really kind of incited.
It facilitated all these stereotypes and a lot of controlling images, particularly those of the black brute, the black male as rapist, as criminal, as predatory.
Yeah. So I think that it's really cool. I mean, it's no accident. It's really cool that he has now reclaimed that title and made it into the opposite, like Nat Turner, the most revolutionary badass black man. So shout out to Nate Parker. I just think that's really awesome.
Yes.
Doc, that is all we have time for Juicy Fruit.
Yes.
Because we have a very interesting feature interview this week. We're going to talk to Christian Phillips, who is from the New American Leaders Project. We're going to talk a bit about the very sad state of Latinos and Asian Americans in local, city, state, national government. So let's take a quick break. We're going to come back and talk about diverse representation and democracy. This is Strange Fruit on WFPO. Are you hungry for more Strange Fruit?
I'm hungry.
Just can't wait for more.
Where else can you go in, get it done your way, and go out without paying?
Visit us online at strangefruitpod.org.
Like us on Facebook.
You like the adulation, the applause.
Or follow us on Twitter at Strange Fruit Pod.
And this is what the gay life is about.
Thanks for listening.
Welcome back. You're listening to Strange Fruit on WFPL. Coming up is our interview with Christian Phillips, a research fellow with the New American Leaders Project and PhD candidate in political science at the University of California, Berkeley.
Now, the NALP is the only nonprofit in the nation that trains first and second generation immigrants to run for office. Christian, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Awesome. Tell our listeners a bit more about the New American Leaders Project. As I mentioned, you all train first and second generation immigrants to run for office. What does that look like? How do you all recruit folks? And then what kind of skills do you all help them develop?
Yeah, the New American Leaders Project is actually unique in that we really think of ourselves as a pan-ethnic organization that's focused on recruiting people from immigrant communities to run for office and then supporting them once they are in office. We work with community partners in communities around the U.S. who are identifying and bringing people to trainings. And we do these great weekend-long trainings that really help people who are thinking about running or maybe not thinking about running, but their friends all think they should, get them into the campaign training and give them really some of the nuts and bolts and some of the confidence that's needed to jump into elections and try to represent their communities.
Okay, great. Okay, Christian, generally, what is the current state of Latino and Asian American representation in government?
It could be better, I will say that. So one of the things we point out in the report is that if you look at all elected state and local offices across the country, fewer than 2% of them are held by Asian Americans and Latinos. And our report really focuses on what's happening in state legislatures, and that's for an important reason. You know, a lot of attention, especially, you know, in a big election year like this, is focused on Congress and the presidency, and those are really important seats, but where a lot of the training and the experience for people who eventually run for those higher offices happens is actually in state legislatures. And in state legislatures, there's really a lot of room for growth and a lot more room for more accurate representation of the communities as they actually are in the United States in 2016. Mm-hmm. So for amongst Asian Americans are actually less than 2% of all state legislators in the United States. And Latinos are less than 4% of all legislators in the United States. Mm-hmm. So that's where things stand. But, you know, we hope that with some of the things that we point out in the report, some of the challenges can be addressed, and we can really move on work on moving up those numbers.
So it's not just necessarily that Asian American and Latino Americans aren't running for office and not winning so much as it's about not having visibility already in government, mm-hmm. and also not having the proper training and channels to tap into to get them kind of ready to run.
And let's talk a bit more about what are some of those barriers, yeah. Christian. So, for example, you yeah. mentioned in the report, there are professional and financial barriers. There's a lack of political networks, perhaps a lack of funding, a fear of failure. What are some of the things, for example, immigration status, language abilities, that get mm-hmm. in the way mm-hmm. of more Latinos and Asian Americans running for office?
Yeah, I think that one of the key things is something that I mentioned. It's this idea of, you brought this up, do you even see yourself in government? Mm-hmm. You know, is that a place for people like you? Let's say you're a committed community activist. You're really vocal on your local, you know, parent association. You really care about improving your neighborhood. But do you see, you know, your state legislature or your local government as a place where you can really do the things you want to get done for your community? You know, in a lot of cases, what we found in the survey is that it really took some convincing for people to see government as a venue for that really could work for them in order to be able to bring the concerns of their community to the table. And so I think that that's definitely one of the big hurdles is helping people see themselves as elected officials and see themselves and see state government and state legislatures as a place where you can really get things done for your community and where it's a good use of your time and worth taking the risk of putting yourself out there as a public candidate.
Yeah.
The other thing that you brought up that is really important is also that, you know, because there are so few people who are already in state legislatures, the pathway to victory is not always crystal clear, right? So somebody from your community maybe has never run for public office. And so that means that the networks that you have to rely on in terms of fundraising, campaign supporters, all of those really kind people who spend every Saturday knocking on doors to put yard signs up and get people to come out and support you, those networks, you have to make them from scratch often. And knowing how to do that can often be really difficult. And the idea of that can sometimes hold people back from being able to take the next step and get on the ballot or take the next step and win that campaign. The other thing that I would bring up that I think is a challenge that we were surprised to see the degree to which it is a challenge is really the role that political parties are playing, right? Mm-hmm. I think that especially in this election year, we've heard a lot of talk about how parties are going to court the Latino vote or how, you know, who's going to be able to really encourage Asian Americans to come out and support their presidential candidate. And so I was frankly a little bit surprised to see the degree to which Latino women in our report, in our survey, were reporting that people from the party actually discouraged them from running. It's, you know, and that's everybody, you know, it was fairly rare amongst most respondents to the survey, but Latino women, 1 in 3, said that somebody from their party actually discouraged them from running. And I think that, you know, what we hope is that people from every kind of organization that's involved in getting people involved in politics, but especially the parties, takes a close look at what they're doing and how they are really reaching out and whether, you know, what they think of as their methods and tactics for bringing more people into the organization and into politics are really effective and are really as inclusive as they might think they are.
Mm. Christian, why is it important and how does it make city, state, and national government better to have a governing body that's representative of the multiculturalism that is the United States? Why is Asian and Latino American and their presence important to our country and to our government?
Yeah, I think there's two pretty basic reasons why. One is, you know, on one level, I think a lot of people tend to think that your government, right, which makes decisions about your life, spends your tax dollars, protects and builds the infrastructure that you know use every day, should probably look a little bit like you or your community, and reflect the community that they're supposed to be representing. So there's that idea, right, that our government should probably look like us, and what the us is in the United States has been changing since 1965. You know, the Asian American and Latino immigration rates have been growing, and frankly the legislatures and the way that they are composed haven't kept up with that growth. And then the second reason is really that there's a lot of evidence out there that people from underrepresented communities not only tend to vote differently than people from majority communities, but they also participate in the governing and legislative process differently. So it's everything from the way they call hearings on different topics and what kinds of witnesses they bring when there's policy discussions in the Capitol to the kinds of collaboration that they are able to do within their parties and across the aisle and the kinds of issues that they prioritize for the legislative agenda. There are real differences in the types of things that people from different communities are going to bring to the table. You know, one good example is we talk in the report about how, you know, there's not a lot happening on immigration at the federal level, but in state legislatures, they are doing lots and lots and lots of things related to immigrants and immigration. And those issues are important, and we should definitely have people with direct ties to immigrant-based communities interacting in that process. And at the same time, you know, people from immigrant communities also want to have good schools and want to have testing that reflects what they need out of their school systems and their education systems and infrastructure that meets their needs. And all of those everyday things that legislatures also work on also should be reflecting the interests and views of people from the communities that they actually serve.
Wonderful. Before we go, Christian, what can we do to fix the inequity? What, you know, you mentioned a few different factors. Is the is the impetus on the individual? Is it on the political parties? Is it on local government to find and nurture new candidates? How do we begin to move forward, especially in Kentucky, where we got an F? How do we do better in terms of encouraging more diverse politicians and political candidates?
You know, I think I really like the way that you asked that question. Is it about the individual or is it about these larger systems? And I have to say that when you look at the national survey work that we've done, it's clearly about looking at systems and larger organizations and how we can think big. You know, there are lots of people out there who have leadership potential and who want to serve their communities. And the question is, how can we get the parties and other organizations that work in communities and organizations that mobilize Latinos and Asian Americans and other people from immigrant communities, how can we get them to reorient their focus on thinking about getting their members and getting their constituents to think about state legislatures as a place to focus their energy? And also, how can we have those organizations also focusing their fundraising and support dollars and resources on state legislatures and state legislative races, which is where Asian American and Latino candidates really thrive and need their continued support. And then I think the other thing is really what I said before about organizations as large as the Democratic and Republican parties and as small as, you know, local and regional organizations that mobilize different groups, thinking about, you know, the ways that they are engaging with communities and, you know, developing leadership and really trying to get people involved in the process. Are we really engaging people in the process in a way that brings everyone along? Or are the things that we do really only bringing parts of communities out and really leaving some groups behind, right? Which is some of the evidence that we saw in the survey with Latina women in particular. I think really having organizations ask those kind of questions and really move forward on trying to refine their practices so that they are really much more inclusive is going to really help advance representation for everyone.
Certainly. Well, indeed, diversity does drive democracy. This has been Christian Phillips of the New American Leaders Project. Christian, thank you so much for being with us, and please take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. So thanks to Christian Phillips. That was very insightful. It sucks that Kentucky got an F, but it wasn't surprising. I mean, I think even if we talk about like local government, I don't think that there are any Asian Americans or Latinos in Louisville's citywide government, countywide government. Before we go, Doc, I wanted to share with you a very interesting article that I saw. There's this dude, and he is actually an attorney, and he specializes in cases of food poisoning. And he has released a list of the six foods that he says that he would never eat. Like, he's probably argued hundreds, if not thousands, of cases of food poisoning over the years. And so he's like, look, these are the foods I would never eat no matter what restaurant I go to. Can you give me your best guess? Like, what foods do you think are probably the most prone to give people food poisoning? Like, people get sick because they ate what?
Oh my God, fish.
Well, okay, you think fish? Okay.
And that's just because I don't like fish.
Yeah, you have an emotional allergy to fish, yeah.
Yes. And then what else?
Because people always think like sushi or like some kind of
maybe
like
soups.
Or like, you know, you think soup, really?
Yeah, well, I just don't trust anything in a can anymore. I mean, not only because of like the mercury and like Alzheimer's, like I just feel like no for things
in a
can. But
most soups No. In a restaurant, aren't looking out of a can. Most people are looking from scratch.
Well, whatever.
Like Campbell. But okay,
whatever. At the store, it's not time to buy soup in a can.
Yeah, I tell you what, raw sprouts. And I remember sprouts because people like sometimes will put them either like in a salad or some kind of like dish. But anyway, raw sprouts are usually a big culprit of salmonella. So bean sprouts, avoid bean sprouts, alfalfa, clove or radish sprouts. They can get you really sick and cause infection. Mm. Also, according to his list, and by the way, this list is by Bill Marler, who is an attorney, and this is from a Food Poison article he did. He said, meat that isn't well done. How do you order your burgers or your steak?
Oh, I order all meats well done, and including even when I eat, if I order chicken from a restaurant, I'm like, I prefer my chicken dry. That's what I'll say, because I just don't like any kind of beef or steak. But I've heard that a lot of chefs really hate well-done steaks and hate well-done
burgers.
Because
they feel like it takes the taste, but I don't believe that.
But I don't want like the blood seeping in the corner, and like I just, to me, it's like Flintstone time, and like I'm not.
Yeah, and this particular attorney mentions that, you know, that meat, you know, is a big culprit of that. Just because you cook the outside doesn't mean that those germs and those diseases on the inside are somehow cooked away.
Mm.
I don't know. I just thought that was interesting. So, you know, listeners, not only is our show entertaining, it's also informative. Now you all know what six foods, food groups to avoid. Because we want you all to be safe and healthy. We want you to come back here next week and enjoy Strange Food with us all over again. So,
okay.
Doc, we're out of time. Say goodbye to everybody.
Bye.
Bye, y'all. Take care.
Strange Fruit is produced by 89.3 WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky. Our producer is Laura Ellis. The views presented on Strange Fruit do not reflect those of Louisville Public Media, its staff, or its underwriters.
I'm Jason Gardner.
And I'm Kyla Story.
Thanks for listening.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard on the web at www.kboo.fm. The time is 6:59. Stay tuned for Hard Knock Radio coming up next.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the first annual Portland Bob Marley Birthday Party, Saturday, February 6th, starting at 6:30 p.m. at the Melody Ballroom in Portland. The life of Bob Marley will be celebrated with live reggae by Simba Puma and the Roaring Lions, by DJs Reggae Bob and Pablo One from Kingston, Jamaica, and live streaming from Kingston's own Bob Marley Festival. Again, that's the first annual Portland Bob Marley Birthday Party, Saturday, February 6th, starting at 6:30 p.m. at the Melody Ballroom at 615 Southeast Alder Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the film screening of Warrior, The Life of Leonard Peltier, Saturday, February 6th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Warrior tells the true story of Leonard Peltier, the American Indian leader locked away for life in Leavenworth Penitentiary. Warrior takes us back to the violent confrontations at Pine Ridge and Wounded Knee in the 70s, and through